Welcome back to the program. It is The Extra here on KRDO News Radio. I'm Paul Richards, your host, and our guest for the second half hour today. We're thrilled to have him here. He's one of the panelists and one of the speakers at the Breaking the Silence Conference, which is going on. It started yesterday at Church for All Nations. His name is William Federer, and he's a historian extraordinaire. Bill, it's great to meet you, and thanks for coming in and making the time for us.
Paul, thank you.
So let's talk about the conference. How's it going so far?
Well, it's tremendous, and my niche is I've written several history books, and there's something you learn from history. You see patterns.
Yes.
And Europe has gone in a pattern from a Judeo-Christian past to a secular, anything-goes type of neutral.
Right.
And now it's going into an Islamic future.
Right. And the Islamists have been continually migrating, immigrating all through the European continent.
They're having fewer children, and in Islam, it's more kids and more wives. And so we see 10 years ago, there were 3 mosques in Germany. Today, there's over 200. And most of the southern Holland is Moroccan Muslim. The number one name for newborns in London, Paris, Milan, you know, is Mohammed. And so we see this trend happening, a Judeo-Christian past, a secular free sex, anything goes neutral, and then Islamic future. And by overlaying that template over what we're seeing in America, we've gone from a Judeo-Christian past. I read through every charter of every colony.
Right.
I found out every colony was founded by a different Christian denomination.
Really?
Virginia was Anglican. Massachusetts was Puritan. Rhode Island was Baptist. New York was Dutch Reformed. Delaware and New Jersey were Swedish Lutheran. Maryland was founded by Catholic. Pennsylvania by Quakers. Connecticut, New Hampshire by Congregationalists. And they did not get along. And they would chase each other out of each other's colonies. But then they had to work together against the King of England during the Revolution. And then they began to tolerate each other. So I read through every state constitution. The original state constitution of the 13, 9 of them required you to be a Protestant Christian to hold state office.
Really?
I mean, here's South Carolina's. The Christian Protestant religion is hereby deemed the established religion of this state.
Wow.
So people say, well, if they wanted it to be a Christian nation, why didn't they put it in their constitutions? They did, the state constitutions. 3 states were really liberal. Maryland said all you had to do was be a Christian.
Okay.
We think of that as narrow-minded. They thought, look, because you could be any denomination,
right,
and even Catholic, right? Then you had Rhode Island had 0 religious requirements. They said that if you required someone to be a Christian, they could say they were just to get elected, and that would be hypocritical. Could you imagine someone saying they're Christian just to get elected?
Impeached.
And then there was an Irish potato famine. Millions of Irish Catholics came over. The Catholic percent went from 2% to 20%, and then they began to tolerate monotheists and polytheists. Finally, they began to tolerate the atheists, and the last ones in the boat decided it was too crowded, and they decided to shove the first ones out.
Oh, I see.
So everybody's tolerated in America, except the Christians that founded the country. Right? So it's an interesting dynamic. But now we're seeing the introduction of Islam,
right,
and large numbers being relocated in Boise, Idaho, and Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Detroit, Michigan. They've infiltrated the drug gangs. Hugo,
right,
Chavez in Latin America had been bringing over Muslim terrorists, and they've learned Spanish and come north. And so now we have them in all the major cities. And so there's a concern going on as to, is this trend that we saw in Europe, this pattern of Judeo-Christian past, secular free sex, anything goes neutral, and now are we beginning to see an Islamification that may be taking place?
That's fascinating, Bill. And if that, in fact, is the case, how long do you think it might take?
Well, each time it happens,
they're very patient. By the way,
You're exactly right. But each time it happens quicker. So like they learn from their mistakes. I point out that we have terrorist attacks, and then some say, well, those people that did the attacks, they don't represent true Islam.
Right.
And then the people that are doing the attacks, they're yelling Allahu Akbar, and they say they are representing true Islam. Who can tell us who is true Islam? Muhammad. Muhammad was the perfect Muslim that ever lived. His life is called the Sunnah, which means the way or the example. And his life went through 3 stages. He was a religious leader for 12 years in the pagan city of Mecca, only made 70 converts in 12 years. The people of Mecca consider him a little bit pushy, and they chase him out of town for disturbing the peace. He flees north 210 miles to a Jewish city called Medina. Jews are nice, let him in as a refugee, as a immigrant, right? A religious, right, immigrant. So they let him into the country, to their city. And he goes into the minority neighborhoods, and he begins to organize a following. We're sort of familiar with the term organizing in the community. And he gets a following, goes back to the Jewish leaders of Medina, and presents himself as a candidate of change, that he's a newcomer to the politics of the city. He can rise above their partisanship. The Jews make a treaty with him, and now he is a political leader in addition to being a religious leader. Then something happens. Muhammad's followers in Mecca get a little pushy, argumentative, threatening. They get chased out of town for disturbing the peace. They go to Medina, and Muhammad allows them to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town.
Wow.
So where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, his attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. He actually got a whole chapter of the Quran from his Allah on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. It's Surah 8, chapter 8, still in there.
Wow.
He gets a fifth of the booty. And so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 warriors defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badra in 624 A.D. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader, and he fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. He even used the catapult when he attacked a city called Al-Ta'if, and when they told him the catapult was killing innocent women and children, his response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers, ISIS killers today say it's okay to kill innocent women and children to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since he is the perfect Muslim, his life is the standard. It's the sunnah, the way. Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they want to be like him, religiously, politically, and militarily. So we're faced with this dilemma in the West where there's freedom for all religions, but right. Islam is not just a religion because Muhammad was not just a religious leader. He was a political and a military leader.
Fascinating stuff, Bill. Fascinating. I had no idea that the story was that complicated and complex.
Well, and we see that those three stages that his life went through where he immigrated into Medina as a religious person. He increased the number of his followers amongst those that felt victimized in the, you know, minority communities, and he became a political leader. Then he became a military leader. That pattern has been happening for 1,400 years, where the first ones come in as immigrants, and they're nice, and they're just religious, and people say, I've met them, they're nice, and so they let more in. More come in, they gravitate together, they form a community, and they get an imam and starts teaching, follow the Quran closer now, and they begin to wear the burqas, and the people begin to say, hey, the neighborhood's changing, and they begin to move out, more move in, and then those that refuse to move out, well, that's when there's some random violence, and there's no witnesses, because no Muslim will testify against another Muslim on behalf of a kafir infidel, so they effectively take over the community and the demographics change.
And they insulate themselves then.
Yes, and so we see that Europe is the blueprint of them coming in and then growing and expanding and then pushing out the previous culture. And why is that important? Well, we're seeing this trend happening in America. I was in Detroit, and a lady had a ministry to pregnant moms. And so she shows up at the Muslim house and has a little present. Well, out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom, and they're all pregnant by the same man. He's practicing Sharia in his house. And then another guy says, oh, Fazl bought a bunch of houses on the street, has a wife in each one. They go into the welfare office, and they end up saying, my husband's not around. They get welfare, and he visits them. And the more kids they have, the larger the checks are. And so he's practicing Sharia law on the block. Then they take over several blocks, and they vote in the school board. And then they have Sharia in the schools. And then they take over more blocks, and then they vote in the police department, fire department. And now they have their minarets and their calls to prayer on loudspeakers 5 times a day, no different than Pakistan. And all the non-Muslims have been driven out. And so we see this pattern of immigrating, increasing, and eliminating. And so maybe when we look at history, it can give us some indication of where this is all headed.
Bill Federer is our guest here on the program today. He is one of the featured speakers at the Breaking the Silence conference going on this week at the Church for All Nations. And all you have to do to register, they do want you to register, but the conference is free. You can go to breakingthesilenceconference.com. We'll be back with our remaining time with Bill Federer coming up on the other side here on KRDO News Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program, 947 here at KRDO News Radio. I'm Paul Richards, and we are thrilled to be joined by historian William Federer. He is taking part in this week's Breaking the Silence conference at the Church for All Nations. And, Bill, I have to ask you, are you related to Roger Federer?
I taught him everything
he knows. I'm sure you get that all the time.
My mom did our family genealogy, and it did go back to Switzerland.
Right.
And so my brother befriended him on Facebook, and we're very, very proud of Roger Federer.
Well, it was a tough loss yesterday. But, hey, the guy's still playing great after all this time.
He is great. I went to college in Europe and would wander into Switzerland. And my sister, we had some Federer friends over there. And so she had actually, she went a couple years before I did. She, like, found this family, and she comes up to him and broken German would say, you know, we're family. See the passport, Federer, we're related. And it was sort of like that Chevy Chase movie. It was like, sure. I guess these are our relatives. We're not quite sure how they connected, but we're related. Right. You know, same last name.
Well, listen, let's talk about history as a whole, Bill. Let's talk about it as a subject matter for a minute. My kids come home from school, and they go to a really good school. And sometimes I'm kind of thinking that some of the teaching when it comes to history is kind of lacking. What do teachers need to do to be effective in teaching history?
Well, I am one. There's my new favorite quote is from Arthur Schlesinger. He is a Nobel Prize or Pulitzer Prize winning author. Was on staff with John F. Kennedy. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, "History is to a nation what memory is to an individual." Could you imagine an individual who's lost their memory? They don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. In America, we've lost our memory. Here we are, the freest and most prosperous country the planet has seen, and we forgot how we got here. You know, people say, well, America's the greatest country in the world. I decided to prove it. So I spent several years researching every civilization that has ever existed on the planet.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking.
And I found some very interesting things. The first was that writing was invented around 3 or 4,000 B.C.
Right, the Sumerians.
Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets. They had a piece of clay, take a stick and poke it in it and bake it. And that was 3 or 4,000 B.C. We're around 2080. That's 6,000 years of recorded human history, human beings writing down human records. And I thought, you know, 6,000 years is not that long.
Drop in the bucket.
It's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. I said, everybody met someone who's lived 100 years, maybe a grandma.
Sure.
We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. And the question I asked when I did the research is, what's the most common form of government? And let's see, there's pharaohs, Caesars, Kaisers, Sultans, Tsars, Maharaja, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila the Hun, King Kamehameha, Montezuma. It's kings.
Right. Monarchies.
It's monarchies.
And we see it even now. England still has a monarchy.
England does. And then every communist country is a monarchy. I thought communism, everybody owns everything equally. Well, let's think a little deeper. Who decides who lives in the nice house and who lives in the dumpy house? Someone in the government dictates that.
Right, a little bureaucracy.
Whoever ultimately dictates that is the dictator. And so every communist country has a dictator. The Communist Party members are the new royalty. They get to live special treatment. And then the people are the peasants. And so even Franklin Roosevelt said, the Soviet Union is run as a dictatorship as absolute as any other dictatorship in the world. But in looking at this history, the most common form of government is power wants to gravitate into the hands of one person. And I think, you know, sort of spiritualized, I think it goes back to the fall in the garden and Cain killing Abel and selfishness coming into the human DNA. So you put some babies in a playpen, one of them will take the rattle from the others.
Sure.
Put some kids on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. Put some people in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief, and put them in the inner city, one of them is the gang leader. And all a king is, in a sense, is a glorified gang leader.
Right.
And it's this hierarchical system. Where if you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you're less equal. You're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason.
Right.
So for most of world history, equality was how close of an orbit can you get to the king. And as these centuries go on, these kingdoms get bigger and bigger and bigger. Sargon of Akkadia, Cyrus of Persia, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, you know, Genghis Khan.
They're all kind of expansionists.
The expansionists. And then the biggest empire the planet had seen was the King of England. He controlled an empire that was 13 million square miles, a half a billion people, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guyana, Canada, and the Americas. And we decided to break away from this king. We have no army, no navy, just a bunch of people with faith and courage. And so when our founders set up the government, they wanted to run in the opposite direction of a king. They took the power of ruling, broke it into three branches, executive, legislative, judicial. They designed a system of government that would be slow on purpose. They realized it could, you know, take forever to get something done, but at least it doesn't have some irreversible decisions. Like, you know, you take a lifetime to build a mansion and one irresponsible match to burn the thing down in a day.
Exactly.
So they took the power and stretched it, and they said, well, all we have on earth is men and women, and we're humans, and we have this selfish nature, and it's going to want to concentrate back into it. And so let's pit it against each other. So the selfishness in the executive branch would always try to take power from the legislative and judicial.
Sure.
Selfishness in the judicial would always try to take power from the executive. And it was greed checking greed. And but unfortunately, after every crisis, we've seen a gradual reconcentration of power. The rubber band wants to snap back.
Right.
And so it was great that Lincoln ended slavery. But in the process, a lot of rights went from the states to the federal government. It was great that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get us through the Depression, but he concentrates power with his New Deal programs.
And four terms.
Yeah, we got elected four times. And then you had LBJ's War on Poverty collects power. Then they noticed that if you collect people's money and give it out as entitlement programs, people have the strongest motivation to vote you back into office.
I was going to say, they will vote for you if they get free stuff.
And then even Bush, you know, he wanted to make sure there's no more terrorist attacks. And so he puts into the NSA and the Patriot Act and everything. And now the new president, no matter what the crisis is, it's surrender more of your life to the government and they'll take care. But when you stand back and look at it, it's like, wait, we're actually moving in the direction of us ruling our lives to the power concentrating into the hands of fewer and fewer people. Mm-hmm. And we're getting back into that patronage system where if you're friends with the person at the top and his agenda, you get the special treatment. And if you don't, you know, you get audited and so forth.
And let me ask you this. Is it too late to reverse course?
People say, can we turn it around? I'm just hoping to slow it down.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a German historian named Oswald Spengler, and he said that history goes through a centripetal and a centrifugal pattern. Sort of like a tetherball where you hit it around a pole and it gets tighter and tighter, tighter, wraps,
faster, faster,
and then you
faster.
Hit it the other way and it unwinds. And so he says that civilizations, they work in this synergy together to become great and powerful, and then when they start flying apart, it happens so fast. I liken it to an athlete when he's young. He's disciplined and focused, does the push-ups, you know, watches his diet, and he wants that prize. The second phase is he gets to be the champ, and he rules undisputed for a while. Then the third stage is he gets lazy, sex, drugs, women, and he ends up getting challenged into the ring by a new up-and-coming athlete. And in his mind, he still thinks I'm the tough guy.
But he gets knocked out.
He gets knocked out. And so civilizations, when they're young, they have a common ethic, it's common language, a common belief system, and they work together, and they become the greatest. And they rule for a while, but then they get indulgent leaders, immorality. They overstretch their boundary in debt. And so what happens, they get challenged by a new up-and-coming empire. And in their brain, they think, we're the world's greatest. And they go in the field of competition, and they end up being displaced. And the next one takes over for a while. And so it's important for us to understand the Byzantine Empire existed from when Rome fell in 476 A.D., it existed another 1,000 years until the Muslim Sultan Mehmet II conquered it. And they had this invincibility complex. They thought, hey, we took over when Rome fell, 1,000 years of politics. You know, we're God's special city country. We missed the bubonic plague. We missed, you know, Attila the Hun. And but then they ended up getting this overconfident, this huge bureaucracy, and then the Muslims conquered it. So empires and civilizations go through this cycle, and if we learn from history, we can maybe try to slow it down and preserve it for our kids.
Well, I think we need to have another program specifically on that topic. If you will come back, Bill, we'd love to have you
back. I would be thrilled.
Excellent. Bill Federer is our guest. He's taking part in the Breaking the Silence Conference. It's going on this week at the Church for All Nations. If you'd like to go, it is free, and you can sign up by going to the website, which is, what is it, Deb? Help me out. BreakingTheSilenceConference.com. All right. Very good. Bill, great meeting you. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Well, thank you, Paul. And my website is AmericanMinute.com, and okay. I send out a free daily email called American Minute with all this history nuggets.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate the time. I look forward to having you back again
thank you.
Real soon. Bill Federer here on the program, ladies and gentlemen. It's 9:57. We'll have Tom Martino, the troubleshooter, up next. We have a great program planned for you tomorrow as well. We hope you'll stay with us. KRDO News Radio.